Welcome to a series of podcasts on childhood obesity. As you may know, I do these podcasts to advertise my books. The book that I am going to be advertising is going to be the paperback and audiobook titled Fat Newborns, Infants, and Kids. Essentially, I'll be reviewing the book through a series of podcasts. I really don't know how many it's going to take. Most of you realize my goal is to prevent type 2 diabetes by getting you to participate in a normal maintenance diet. To prevent type 2 diabetes, I have to prevent prediabetes. And to prevent prediabetes, I have to prevent obesity. And if you have either prediabetes or obesity, I have to get you to do something so that these do not progress. Finally, I am going to have to help you get rid of your obesity. At the present time, 42% of the adults in the U.S. are obese. 70 years ago, this was about 23%. 70 years before that, it was even less. Something has happened in the last 100 to 200 years, as opposed to the rest of recorded history, that has left us with obesity. Obesity is part of the problem, but obesity is a precursor to type 2 diabetes, which leads to all kinds of other medical issues. In addition, you really can't have obesity, prediabetes, or type 2 diabetes without having some level of insulin resistance. This means that your insulin level is going to be higher than most of recorded history. The high level of insulin itself causes numerous medical issues. So we have obesity, which leads to prediabetes, which leads to type 2 diabetes, and now about 14% of the adults in the U.S. have type 2 diabetes. I have written a book, Diet and Health, in which I go into detail as to what has happened in the last 200 years to get us into this situation. I can't cure type 2 diabetes with diet, although I can help manage it and perhaps get the blood sugar to normal and decrease the medications required. But even if I do, you are not cured. I believe I can keep many of those with prediabetes from progressing to type 2 diabetes. Then I don't have to cure you of anything. Both type 2 diabetes and prediabetes are usually preceded by obesity. Again, my main goal is to prevent type 2 diabetes. Therefore, I must treat obesity, or better yet, keep you from getting obese to start with. I have written a great deal on how to accomplish this goal through a proper diet. I will tell you up front, and many of you already know this, that exercise plays a minor role in this. I have given you the information you need on nutrition and metabolism, what happens when you eat, and when you don't eat, as well as the basics of fasting, and how we got to where we are now, despite not having an obesity epidemic in the previous 5,000 years. I explained how our modern food induces insulin resistance. I have tried to explain to you the diet to lose weight, the diet to be on if you had any insulin resistance, and the diet for the entire family to be on for the next 50 years. There is a gap in this information. The incidence of being overweight or obese for the ages 2 through 19 is now 33%, with the obesity incidence being 20%. 50 years ago, in this age group, it was 5%. If I am really interested in preventing obesity and type 2 diabetes, we must look at this problem. My diet and health book was directed at adults, although the maintenance diet also applies to infants. The reasons that newborn and infant obesity is rising has multiple factors, some of which we cannot control. That does not mean we cannot reduce the incidence of childhood obesity and hence adult type 2 diabetes. I am not going to review everything I taught you previously, but I am going to introduce you to epigenetics, as this plays a prominent role in infant obesity. There is something we can do to change the infant's and parent's diet to decrease the chance of obesity. The infant eats at the table with the adults, and we must change the adult's diet to change the infant's. I'll tell you up front, I am not going to advise anyone have children fast more than 12 hours or go on a ketogenic diet. Once the child becomes a teenager, this may change a little. Okay, now my standard disclaimer. I say standard, but it has changed over the years. Remember, I am a retired physician and hence not in the business of giving medical advice. You want medical advice, you go see your healthcare provider. The best way to start this story is by examining the Dutch famine. During World War II, the Nazi government cut off the delivery of food to part of Western Netherlands. This was for various reasons, but this was a punishment to these people. This began in November 1944 and lasted till May 1945, so it had a pretty distinct beginning and ending. This was a country who had a well-developed medical system and hence good medical records that can be researched to this day. Therefore, it was possible to go back and study the medical records of the women who were pregnant or became pregnant during this famine and determine what effect the exposure to famine had on the children and also the grandchildren. Now, this was a real famine, with the average caloric intake of the population affected dropping to about 500 calories per day. Remember, most of us eat around 2,000 calories a day. Also, let us remember that starvation is a distinct metabolic state and is somewhat different from a reduced caloric intake diet. Also remember, fasting means no caloric intake. Starvation is no caloric intake with no fat reserves. There is some overlap, but remember, fasting, starvation, and a reduced calorie diet are all separate metabolic states and have their own characteristics. Let us look at the infants who experienced the famine while in the womb. We will consider the infants who were conceived before the famine and hence exposed in the womb in the last trimester of pregnancy, and those who were conceived during the famine and were in the first trimester of pregnancy during this time. First, let us look at what we observe during a normal pregnancy. The placenta is very efficient in absorbing nutrients provided by the mother, including various minerals, hormones, glucose, and other nutrients absorbed by the gut and present in the maternal circulation. This absorption is usually a one-way street, and the baby can absorb things like iron or calcium and actually cause defects in the mother. Even during low caloric intake by the mother, the placenta can scavenge enough nutrients to keep the baby alive. One can say that what the mother is eating, the baby is eating. Of course, we remember that whatever is absorbed by the gut usually goes through the portal vein to the mother's liver first before going to the placenta, so not everything the mother eats gets to the baby. Some may be detoxified or modified by the liver. It is not too difficult to observe that obese mothers often have obese babies. We also see this with gestational diabetes, and observe this may be secondary to elevated glucose and insulin in the mother or baby. Similarly, malnourished mothers, through a poor diet or continuing disease or placental dysfunction or drug usage, often have small babies. We would therefore reasonably expect that women who were pregnant during a famine would have smaller than average babies. This was true if the mother was in the first group. That is, the mother was pregnant before the famine, and the baby spent the last trimester in the womb during the famine. The baby was born small. This seems reasonable, since a lot of the growth occurs in the last trimester, and if food was scarce, less nutrient was available to the baby. Similarly, if the baby was conceived in the last part of the famine, it received normal nutrients during the last trimester, and the weight was normal. You may now be wondering why I am telling you this story. If we look at these babies 40 years later, we see an unexpected result. The first group of babies who were exposed to famine in the last trimester remained small, despite having all the food they wanted, for the most part, for the next 40 years. They did not catch up. Not only that, they had a lower rate of obesity than the general population. Most of the time, just being small when you are born does not protect you from obesity. Not only that, but the babies who were exposed to the famine early in pregnancy, but not in the latter part, had a normal birth weight, but also had a higher incidence of obesity than the general population, more than the babies who were exposed to famine. Again, this was 40 years later when these children ate whatever they wanted during adulthood. When we compare these two groups to their brothers and sisters that were later born without a famine, we did not see this pattern and they appeared to be normal. Whatever happened to these two groups of babies did not seem to change the mother or the father's DNA, and just affected the children of the famine and not their siblings. I started out by trying to prevent type 2 diabetes and went in reverse order. I explained what type 2 diabetes was and how it was caused by diet. I advised I could not cure it, but may be able to manage it. I discussed pre-diabetes and how aggressive dietary therapy may prevent its progression. I then went on to obesity and how a proper temporary diet can reduce the excess fat. I then spent some time discussing what diet you needed to be on if you had insulin resistance, which most obese people have. I then discussed a maintenance diet for normal people to use over a lifetime to prevent the development of obesity, prediabetes, and type 2 diabetes to begin with. Okay, now I thought, all I have to do is to get these kids to be on a good diet, and I can prevent them from getting fat. Turns out, that is not the case for everyone. These people who experience famine in the womb were predestined to be either small or obese, probably despite what diet they were on. I was not finished with my goal of preventing type 2 diabetes. I will explain what I think is happening and what may be done as the book goes on. Before I can continue, I must teach you something about epigenetics. For most of you, this will be your first exposure. I am going to introduce you to the subject and give you enough information so we can understand what may be happening. So trust me in this a little longer. This is going to be the end of Podcast 1, Fat Babies. I'll just name them Podcast 2, 3, and 4, and so forth. All this information is available at kellygregg.com. Remember, I do not make my living doing podcasts, but rather selling audiobooks, ebooks, paperbacks, and so forth, as well as doing odd jobs.